Hello and welcome to this episode of Meet the Entrepreneur, brought to you by Invest Africa Insights. Today we're turning the concept on its head, and instead of being joined by a founder, we're going to be speaking to someone who sits on the other side of the coin. I'm delighted to be joined today by Andreata Mforo, who is partner at the venture capital firm TLCom. Andreata, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you on.
Thanks, Eleanor. It's good to be here.
So TLCom has been supporting innovative entrepreneurs that leverage tech to find market solutions to significant challenges since 1999. And earlier this year, you closed your Tide Africa fund at $71 million, which is very exciting. And I'm sure listeners will recognize many of the names in TLCom's portfolio, including Cobra 360, Twiga Foods, and New Lesson, who we've actually had on the show before. So Andreata, just to start us off, I thought we could talk a little bit about what the landscape is looking like now for African VC. Obviously, last year was a bumper year, breaking records with Disrupt Africa, measuring $490 million raised over around 300 startups. And 2020 was also set to be another record-breaking year, but then COVID-19 hit. So it'd be really great to start us off to get your sense of where the market is now in light of that disruption and that change.
Sure. So yeah, it's 2020 has been a year of a kind, right? As we face this global pandemic and then kind of the economic impact of that. So in terms of its impact on the VC landscape, I can speak about it from two fronts. So one is around how it's impacting companies and the actual entrepreneurs, and then how it's impacting us as, you know, VC funds and as investors. So from the, you know, from the entrepreneur side, there's been, you know, quite a bit of upheaval in terms of, you know, initially around your liquidity as a business. So as you can imagine, because of the, you know, the lockdowns, the restrictions in movements, the revenues for companies will likely not grow as high as they had anticipated. So on the revenue side, that will either be flat or the growth will be there, but not, you know, to the extent that they had imagined. And then also on the fundraising side, a number of companies that were contemplating fundraising have put their plans on hold, or are looking to raise capital more internally because, you know, investors are not flying in, for example. And some, at least in March and April, many investors were stepping back to support their own portfolios versus looking at new investments. I think generally that has changed, and we see a little bit more activity compared to, say, in March and April this year. And So you find that, I mean, companies are really having to refocus and look inward and, you know, look and see what are emerging opportunities. How can I adjust my operations to be able to survive fundamentally? I think 2020 is just a year to be able to survive because of the disruption, the economic disruption that has been brought. So how do you refocus yourself as a business and then prepare yourself to grow post the, you know, the pandemic coming under control? So that's what we're seeing a lot with, you know, with the companies themselves and how they're thinking about how to navigate the pandemic. And then for investors, what we're seeing is, you know, initially, you know, March, April was a lot about triaging your portfolio and seeing how do I support my portfolio in terms of, is there capital that they need? Are there strategic decisions that they have to make? A number of them had to cut costs, you know, very difficult decisions, laying people off. So how can we as investors support them through that? So we saw a lot of internal bridge rounds, you know, taking place for companies that already have investors, or for companies that, you know, don't have a lot of liquidity, many were laying off people and cutting costs and operations. So it's been, you know, quite a, you know, a difficult year in that respect. And then on the in terms of new investments, initially I think so, you know, back, you know, first towards the end of the first quarter, second quarter, there was a little less activity as people were trying to adjust and, you know, and figure out how do we operate in this new environment. I think the deals that are being done are ones that have been in conversation prior to the crisis, and where the business model still makes sense, you know, even during the crisis. So we closed our investment in Okra back in April. And this is an investment, a company we'd been speaking to even prior to, you know, since last year. So it was just an issue of completing, and that's what you see as well. But yeah, I think as investors, we're facing the question of how do we operate, especially I think the challenge is mostly investing in an entrepreneur you've never met before, you know, whereas, you know, if you have a prior relationship, that makes sense. I think the funds that will really benefit are the ones that are locally based. So I sit in Nairobi, and then we also have an office in Lagos. So I can put on my mask and go to visit, you know, a company, go meet entrepreneurs. So it's a much easier for us to make new investments. And as TLCom, we're fairly, you know, we've taken a long-term view and are quite excited about, you know, the tech ecosystem. So we're continuing to be active in terms of looking at new investments. And the fact that we're locally based has really served us well. And then I think the other piece around what's happening within the VC ecosystem is also around the funds themselves. So we did a final close of our fund earlier this year. This was the final close, but we had, you know, closed we'd done our first close a couple of years back. And what we've also, which I think was great timing before the, you know, the crisis. The cases really started to raise, luckily. However, what we're also seeing is that, you know, some funds who were in the process of fundraising have decided either to stop or to delay their fundraisers because the environment is just difficult to navigate. I mean, you know, when you're fundraising, you really need to go out and to meet investors, and they need to become comfortable with you, your portfolio. But if people can't travel, it makes it difficult. And it just means that the process will take much longer. I think in the long term, though, when I think about the VC landscape, there's a lot of benefit that we're getting from the pandemic in the sense of digital transformation and acceleration that's happening on the continent. I think we've been catapulted a couple of years into the future. If you think about, you know, spaces like e-commerce, last mile distribution, digital payments, mobile payments, which are spaces that, you know, it takes a lot to get people comfortable transacting digitally. But because of the crisis and because of the restrictions that we are facing, people have almost had to be pushed into operating that way. So I think, you know, those are some of the long-term benefits that the tech ecosystem will reap. Of course, in the short term, there is economic disruption, both from, you know, the income levels of people being impacted as well as business revenues.
Yeah, it's interesting there that you mentioned starting to look a bit more long term. You know, we've had sort of 6 months of kind of crisis response, and I think now lots of people are starting to think, how do I plan for the next 2, 3, 5 years? So I was curious to get your thoughts on what the sort of if there would be a more profound impact over that time frame. I'm thinking, obviously. African VC is quite young, and there are quite a lot of funds that were raised in sort of 2017, 2018, 2019. They've gone through their fundraising cycle and yourselves as well earlier this year. Are you concerned at all about what will happen once we move into a new fundraising cycle across those kind of those funds that were raised pre-COVID? Are we going to see difficulty there perhaps in a few years' time?
I think what we will see is you know, a good number of the kind of the larger funds are anchored by DFIs, and you know, with a little capital from, say, high net worth individuals or just private institutions. And I think what's becoming apparent is, you know, these development finance institutions are quite keen to continue to support the space. So, I mean, there's a continuum around the ones that are more, that are fairly risk averse, and then the ones that are fairly open to continue to support the ecosystem. And I think over time, and as people are understanding the pandemic more, you find that, you know, they're back into the game and they're back looking and back investing. So I think over time, because of the backing, because it's DFIs who are mainly behind at least some of the larger in funds on the continent, which are not many, I think they will continue to support the ecosystem because a lot has been built and it's still growing, it's still maturing. And at least what we're telling them is, you know, let's not lose the benefits and the gains that we've gotten up to date, but continue to support this ecosystem. But certainly there will be impact for 2020, because I mean, if you think about revenues, this year will either be a flat year or just minimal growth for many companies, and that, if you think about your revenue projections, that's really pushing out your revenue growth or when you're anticipating to exit by perhaps, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 years out compared to before. So there will be some impact, but my hope is everybody understands that, you know, this is a very unusual year. It's not Africa specific. This is a global issue. So I think if the fundamentals of a company are still in place, are still intact, and they're able to rebound from this crisis, then it still is a good opportunity. And I think for us also, you know, we're looking at cash on cash return. So yes, you hold your investment for another maybe one to two years, but hopefully the return, at least your cash on cash return, will still be in the same range.
Yeah, that's interesting. And in that sort of that vein of sort of looking at the fundamentals of a company and sort of relying on those, I was interested to ask you, have you changed what you're looking at all? As a result of the change in the landscape? Are you looking at different sectors, different markets than before? Where do you think is sort of quite resilient at the moment and you're looking at?
Sure. So our strategy has always been around supporting businesses that are leveraging technology to provide services to African businesses and African consumers. So it's really fundamental core GDP verticals and core services that these companies are serving, and the spaces that have been resilient have fundamentally been essential services. So you know, it's your food, it's your health, it's education. So those are the spaces that are quite resilient. Because the demand is there, and of course there's a second order impact, which is around incomes are coming down. So, for example, we're invested in a company here in Kenya called Twiga Foods, where they're in the agriculture supply chain, and they're moving fresh fruits and vegetables and FMCG products from farmers to the vendors that you see on the streets, so the mama bogas that you see on the streets. So food remains important, yes. However, the income of the consumer has gone down slightly because, you know, people are losing jobs or they're getting their salary cut. So what you find is the demand is still there. And then maybe you now as a business are thinking about you change your strategy a bit around, maybe it's not going deep into that one particular vendor, but you're spreading wide across many vendors and many geographies to be able to capture more market share and more growth because of what's the upheaval that we're experiencing in the within the economy right now. So we remain, you know, quite bullish and quite excited about, you know, essential services. These are essential services and what we term as, you know, kind of broken verticals, which are spaces where there's a lot of fragmentation. So if you think about some of our investments, we've invested in logistics, in agriculture, in fintech. So these are spaces where the demand is there, but innovation is needed and is required to increase access to services and also to reduce cost of serving the individual. I mean, we're also quite keen, you know, on healthcare. I think that's also one space that's seeing a lot of transformation and innovation right now as well. So I think we're keenly looking at that space, as well as continue to be quite excited about the fintech space, where we now have one investment in our portfolio, but, you know, looking at other companies in this space as well.
And I know that because you're as you said, very focused on investing in tech, in companies that leverage tech to fill the gaps in services that exist. You know, it's something that that we hear a lot about, and spoken a lot about in terms of African markets, and the potential to leapfrog and to really make big strides on issues around food security, food supply, healthcare, you know, all these really big issues. But we also hear quite a lot about sort of challenges in creating a healthy innovation ecosystem. And I know you do a lot of work in this area. So I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about your view of the sort of tech entrepreneurial landscape and the markets you operate in. Do you feel like it's healthy at the moment? What do you think could be improved to drive, to encourage more innovation, to encourage more people to take those steps?
Sure. So, I mean, the tech ecosystems in, we operate across sub-Saharan Africa. And what we find is that it ends up being three primary markets where we see the vast majority of deal flow, which is, you know, as you can imagine, Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa. And then you have secondary markets, which are, say, Ghana, Uganda, and we see quite a bit coming from Cameroon as well, and Ethiopia. So the ecosystem, while we operate across sub-Saharan Africa, you find that there are a few markets where you see that are farther ahead in terms of the development of the ecosystem, and it's still early. I think it's not even more than 10 years when we could start to really speak about an ecosystem. So when you compare it to Silicon Valley, that's been there for decades and decades, we're still fairly early days within the ecosystem. And many strides have been made actually from say 10 years ago, where, you know, in the beginning it was a lot of accelerators and incubators working hard to spur the ecosystem, to increase access to, you know, say co-working spaces, say mentoring, and grants for entrepreneurs. And now we're at a place where we're talking about Africa having raised, you know, depending on which report you read, $1 billion, $2 billion. African startups have raised, you know, $1 billion to $2 billion in capital, say in 2019. So there's been some strides that have been made within the ecosystem, but I think we still have a long way to go. There are a few, you know, key things that we still need to see within to get the ecosystem to a place where we can say, okay, it's fairly mature now. And I think some of the things that we need, and it differs, you know, from country to country, and depending on how developed the ecosystem is. But I'm, the first thing that I would say is, which is very basic, but I think, you know, it's for some African countries, it's not all that apparent. The first is just really around having robust and reliable infrastructure so that you can have tech entrepreneurs. So I'm talking here about, you know, connectivity around electricity. And it's not just about availability of that, but it's also about making sure that it's affordable. So people can access it, and then you can access it at a price point that makes sense, and that's that allows you to be able to operate quite efficiently. So that's one. So the first piece within the ecosystem is just the infrastructure, and then I think also we need more founders. And I think this is happening more and more. Even when I look at our deal flow and our pipeline, we do see many founders coming up. And I think this, as we get serial entrepreneurs, so I think it's also just a matter of time. As you get, you know, serial entrepreneurs, you will find that this piece of the ecosystem will also begin to strengthen. So as founders get more experienced, the ecosystem will and give back to the ecosystem, or even invest back into the ecosystem. That will also, you know, strengthen our ecosystem. I think, and then also, I think the big one, I would think it's big, but maybe others would beg to differ. But I think capital remains important for our ecosystem to be able to continue to grow. So yes, you know, we've made some strides, but you know, if you compare, say, for example, Africa got about $2 billion in capital last year. I think this is the highest estimate you'll see. China was $49 billion. The USA was $136 billion. So you find that, yes, we're making strides, but there's still quite a bit of a funding gap. And I think also as you speak to entrepreneurs, you will find that is the case, that yes, we are seeing capital come to the continent. But I think what's lacking is more capital that's dedicated to the Africa continent, not necessarily somebody who bumped into a company and then invested, but vehicles such as ours and other funds on the continent that are purely dedicated to supporting the ecosystem. I think that, you know, as we get more and more capital, that will also spur the development of our ecosystem. And then I think, the next ingredient that I think will help also improve our ecosystem is really around exits and getting good return for investors, which, you know, it's still an early ecosystem. This year we've seen, you know, a few that have taken place. So, you know, Direct Pay Online, there was Bionic, which was acquired by MFS. So there are a few fintech, you know, exits that are happening. In fact, actually, us as Telkom, we also exited two of our African companies a couple of years ago. So we sold one to a private equity fund, and then we sold another one to BlackBerry. So there are still few exits in the ecosystem. So they are there, but they are few. But I think as we get more exits and as we return capital back to investors, that will actually draw more capital into the ecosystem. That also it will attract more capital into the ecosystem. And then also you also build role models, right? Because, you know, as founders exit and as the ecosystem and as other entrepreneurs see that actually I can become successful as an entrepreneur, I don't only have to be to get a regular job. If I have a passion and ambition to solve a problem, I can be a successful entrepreneur. Then we also get more entrepreneurs coming and feeding into the ecosystem. So I think, yeah, we still have a long way to go. And if we can get, you know, some of these things are stuff that, you know, that's done by the government, if you're thinking of large private companies. So if you're thinking about the infrastructure piece of building a tech ecosystem, but the rest are also done, you know, around, you know, as we continue to grow, as you attract more talent to the continent, then we're also able to build stronger companies and then attract more investment. So it is just a matter of time in my view. And my hope is that, you know, the pandemic doesn't set us too far back from where we had been building and what we had achieved to date.
No, that's very interesting. And I'm interested that you mentioned it a bit about role models and sort of establishing precedents. And I was interested to ask you about another sort of structural issue we see often in the VC entrepreneurial landscape, which is a fairly consistent gap in fundraising between female-run and male-run companies, between female and male founders. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we keep seeing such a gap there?
This is it's a great question, and it's a question that's really close to my heart as a as a female operating also in this in this space, and I think, yeah, you're right. And you know, on the continent as well as in developing markets, there is a huge discrepancy around female founders being able to raise capital, and I think it takes a lot from the ecosystem, because you know, you lose a lot on diversity, on quality of ideas, quality of decisions, quality of companies. I think even, yeah, so there's a loss that, you know, when 50% of the population is not actively participating, it's a huge loss. I think more specifically in terms of why there is a consistent gap, I think it's a couple of reasons. I think the first one is, for what I've seen, is operating as a VC investor on the African continent. One is just the pipeline, right? There's just a smaller pool of female tech founders on the continent. So if you, like in our pipeline, we see about 15 to 20% of the pipeline that we see. And this is also after, you know, actively participating, you know, in different events and being visible and, you know, spur and encouraging female founders to come on board and to speak to us. We see about 15 to 20% of our pipeline is female founders. So there's a piece of it that's just in terms of the pipeline is small. So if the pipeline is small, then that means the numbers you end up investing are also going to be small. So they'll be within, you know, that general range. I think that's one key issue. And then I think the other issue is around, you know, the fact that, you know, venture capital is very much relationship driven. And I think it also applies on the continent as well. And I think female founders have a hard time penetrating through this ecosystem, because I think many partners for funds are typically also male partners. So how do you get into these networks? So I think this, which is a question for us as VC investors to think about, how do we make it more open, more comfortable for female founders to also, you know, reach us and to have discussions with them. And then I think maybe one of the final reasons I would think this is the case also is just around a lack of, there's just, you know, and I think it feeds into the other two points I had raised, is that what you end up with is a community of female founders that's not very strong, because there are few of them, and because many are operating in cycles, the community is very small. So you find that we're not able, like the female founders are not able to support each other or to get the help and the support that they need. And these are things that, you know, we at TLCOM have also recognized and have kind of made it one of our missions to be able to see how can we actively support tech female founders on the African continent. So, you know, just starting from our own team, we have a team where 50% of our partners are females. And we really think about diversity, and we really value diversity, and we want to see it in our pipeline. So I have been working to support tech female founders, you know, through various initiatives. So the first, we started a summit last October was the first version of the summit, where we essentially brought 50 female founders. We had the event in Lagos to support them to build a network around each other, learn from each other, and be able to create a community where they can, you know, be able to support each other. And we've received, you know, feedback that many of the founders are still in touch with each other. Some have merged companies out of that event. One of the founders was telling me. So this is a space, I think, one has to, like, at least for us as TLCOM, we've taken a proactive approach to see how can we play a part to change the narrative and make sure that there is more inclusion of female founders within our pipeline.
And do you think that also making sure there's more women on your side of the table as well, because that's the other aspect here, how would could help accelerate the a change.
Absolutely, absolutely, because I think a couple of points on that. So one is I think there's the comfort and the comfort that I think entrepreneurs can get from pitching or, you know, presenting their business to a mixed team, I think is also a good signal to the founders. I think they would get more comfort to articulate their businesses and to approach the VC. And I think it also says something about the VC company itself and how they operate and how they think. And then also, I think it's also important because sometimes, female founders, they start businesses in spaces that they know well or that and that are kind of blind to, say, males. So say, for example, if you're running a business in beauty, if you're running a business, baby clothes line, there are just some spaces where women are very knowledgeable about. So if you run such a business, for example, and then you pitch that business to, say, an all-male VC, they may not understand the business, so they may not end up investing because they don't understand the business. Not that because there's an issue with your company in particular, but if you have a diverse VC team, then you will have people who understand the business from being a user perspective as well. So at least, it gives the idea an opportunity to be debated and really looked at closely without it being, quickly being brushed away as maybe, not a large market or just something that they don't understand. So they can't really support a company because they don't understand the space. So I think that's quite key. It's an important piece, like for us as VC investors, to also have diversity within our teams. And then I think also the other piece that can help bridge this gap is around, I think also, again, as VC teams, to think about how do we increase our pipeline. Because it's true there in the general market, there are few female founders, but how do you make sure that you as a VC investor are also just seeing more female founders within your pipeline? So it takes a proactive role to seek that out and bring them in. I think also another piece is around role modeling. Because there are very few female founders, the ones that are doing well, I think it will be important for them to kind of take the mantle and be able to tell their stories so that other female founders can see them. And then when they see them, then they can, you can connect the dot between this is my reality and this is the potential that I can get up to as well.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Hopefully we will start to see some more movement in that space, because as you say, otherwise you miss out on a sort of huge amount that people have to offer. To sort of close us off, what I thought might be helpful for people listening would be if someone's listening, male or female, and they are looking for funding, what are your key pieces of advice? If they were coming to you, what are your sort of key pieces of advice in terms of presenting and pitching and coming up with a strong business model?
Sure. So maybe just a few thoughts on that. So I think the first one is, as an entrepreneur and as a founder, I think you need to become an expert at your business. And that's something within your control, because it's the business that you're running, 24/7 fundamentally. So as an entrepreneur, when you're approaching investors, when you show up, make sure you know your business really well. In terms of whether it's the unit economics, your business model, your competitive advantage, make sure you have a good grip and a good grasp on your business. I think that's one. And then, you know, aligned with that is really focusing on execution. So making sure that you're gaining traction on your on the customers that you're getting on the market that you're serving. Because in practice, so yes, I mean, people generally talk a lot about biases with the investors, but honestly, if you show up with a business that's showing traction, that's growing in terms of revenue, in terms of users, and has significant potential, any investor would be biased towards that. So I think as an entrepreneur, focus on execution, showing significant traction for your business that attracts investors, because fundamentally investors are looking to invest in businesses that are, you know, that can create value and that can return capital. So if you can show that, then fundraising will not be as difficult as it usually is. I think I think when you're approaching investors, it's also good to understand. So to reach out to the investors to see if there's alignment, and then also to understand how investors make decisions. I think there's usually a gap and a divide between entrepreneurs and investors and how investors think. So for example, if you're approaching Telkom, for example, what we're looking at, and I think it's fairly typical of other investors as well, is, you know, kind of three buckets of questions that we're trying to answer. So very broad, I'll explain this quite broadly. So the first one is this an attractive market? So what we mean by that is we're looking for large growing markets that have potential for, you know, significant value generation, and where there could be a potential exit for us and for our investment a couple of years down the line. And then is this a good market? And then is this a good company? And what we're looking at on the company is we're really looking to find out what's the uniqueness of your business model. And so yes, it's a great market. And can your business model solve this problem? And then is this the team that can execute on this business model? And then the third question is for us is this a good investment? So there we're looking as an investor in terms of the terms that we get, that we're able to get from as part of the transaction. So at Telkom, we take board seats. We are active investors and want to support the entrepreneurs. And then there are other, you know, minority protection rights that we ask for as investors. So if a company is able to tick the, you know, is this an attractive market? Is this a good company? Is this a good investment? Then we invest. So I think also as an entrepreneur, it's important for you to try and get into the mind of an investor and figure out how they're looking to make their decision. So that also, as you present your company, you can be able to answer some of those questions. And then I think the other point I think for entrepreneurs is their fundraising is just to be mentally prepared for the journey, because I think, you know, many times CEOs think that fundraising is something they do on the side and it's not really part of their job description. When actually it is, because if your business needs capital to grow, then yes, it's part of your job description. So I think as you go into the fundraising phase of your business, it's important to understand and to accept that this is a difficult process. It's quite, you know, it's quite taxing on many founders. But to understand that you need to do it and to own it in that respect. And I think if it's any consolation, us also as investors, we also need to fundraise. So in as much as, you know, you're fundraising with us, we also have to fundraise from our investors. So we do understand and do empathize, you know, the time it takes, the energy it takes to do fundraising, because I mean, most entrepreneurs just want to run their business. So, But in order to run your business, you need the capital. So you need to also own the fact that this is truly part of your job description and it also has to be done well.
Yeah. And Josh, thanks so much for speaking to me today, coming on the show. I think, you know, lots of people will find your insights not only really interesting, but also really helpful. So thank you for that. And if people want to hear more from you, you're actually going to be speaking at Invest Africa's annual conference, the Africa Debate, which is happening on the 5th of November, and it's a virtual conference this year, so people can tune in from wherever they are in the world and hear more from Andreata, as well as another great cast of speakers. So if listeners want to get themselves a ticket, they can get a 10% discount by using the off code INSIGHTS2020 at checkout at theafricadebate.com. Andreata, thanks so much again for coming on.
Great, thank you. Thanks for your time.